owl spooks them, and they all take flight simultaneously. That big whoosh is the wings of 1,000 snow geese beating together, creating a rush of air like a passing freight train. Here it is one more time. As the tornado of geese whirls in the air, their calls build to an enormous crescendo. Like a school of fish swimming close together when there's a shark, these snow geese use their numbers to protect themselves. Flying in a big, compact flock, they make it harder for a predator to pick off a single bird. It's a display of skill and grace that, for a snow goose, is just a fact of life. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Rimmel. BirdNote is grateful to Dr. Gordon Oriens, a co-founder of BirdNote's Science Advisory Council, for his generous ongoing support.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad.
Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Partnership for Safety and Justice is the leading public safety and criminal justice reform organization in Oregon. Their impact has helped reduce mass incarceration and ensure accountability, racial equity, and healing. PSJ will soon celebrate 25 years of challenging the status quo and transforming Oregon's criminal legal system. My guests from Partnership for Safety and Justice and Safety and Justice Oregon are Shannon White, Deputy Director, and Bebek Zalbagari Azar, Senior Policy Manager. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shannon, let's start with, who is Partnership for Safety and Justice? Talk about the work of the organization.
Yeah, thank you, Karen. Partnership for Safety and Justice has been around for 25 years. It was essentially, actually, it's two organizations to begin with, by two fabulous women, one whose daughter was incarcerated and one who was paralyzed in a drunk driving crash. And those organizations came together and formed Partnership for Safety and Justice. And since then, we've been advocating for both reforms that bring healing and safety to both crime survivors and people convicted of crime. And we do that by really working to shrink the number of people under any kind of correctional control, prisons, jails, supervision. There are far too many people on supervision or in some kind of correctional control, and advocating for resources to go into the community to really help, again, people and communities heal and thrive.
I can also add, again, Bebek Zalbagari Azar, I'm the Senior Policy Manager. And I always like to start by saying that my own justice involvement as a young adult in Oregon brought me to this work. And I'm grateful to have an opportunity to be a senior policy manager with Partnership for Safety and Justice and Safety and Justice Oregon. Zooming in a little bit, Partnership for Safety and Justice is transforming our response to crime with innovative solutions. We're building a system that better serves survivors of crime, people convicted of crime, and the communities and families of both. And we do this in two specific ways, Karen: shrinking the system and investing in communities. So with shrinking the system, you know, there are times when people need to be separated from the community for safety reasons, but more incarceration doesn't necessarily make us safer. And we know that mass incarceration is harmful. It tears too many families apart, and it devastates communities of color who are disproportionately targeted. So the policies that we advance reduce prison use, as, you know, as Shannon said, jail use and supervision, while still keeping our communities safe. The other is investing in communities. So that piece there, we need to really look at local programs that help people be accountable for harm and violence. And, you know, the services that help restore crime victims' lives are tied into this. So, you know, we need to give people the help that they need, including mental health and addiction treatment, so they don't end up in the system in the first place, right? We fight for funding that helps people and communities truly heal, which we'll talk about later in the interview.
And Bebek, I like what you said initially, how you came to this work. And this is what PSJ is about. You involve the stakeholders. You involve people with lived experience, and you're empowering those people, and you're building coalitions around grassroots organizations. So talk a little bit about that.
In a way that brings me back to that justice involvement, right? I remember being in the back of a police vehicle after my senior year of graduating high school. And I still remember deeply like how much I wanted to be able to work in collaboration with marginalized communities and oppressed communities to be able to change the sort of experiences that I was only beginning to see in the back of that vehicle, right? When I was illegally pulled over, illegally arrested, taken as a kid, teenager to an adult jail. That was just the beginning of like, okay, something needs to be done about this, right? And then, you know, you can fast forward to the second experience I had as a little bit older young adult when I was a senior in college, getting ready to go to law school. And that totally transformed my life. Another illegal arrest, illegal search and seizure, that sort of thing. And again, I was like, God, I really want to align and work with other people who've experienced this to be able to make a difference in our communities. And so, you know, a lot of the work that we do is in coalition. That's why one of the reasons I love working with Safety and Justice Oregon and Partnership for Safety and Justice. And so the Transforming Justice Coalition, which Shannon and I co-lead, is a powerful space where we can do that, right? The coalition came together during the racial justice reckoning in the summer of 2020. Some of the organizations at the table include Central City Concern, Sponsors, Urban League, Next Up, and Red Law Transition Services, and many more. So we're really excited that we're working together on policies during this upcoming legislative session and in past sessions as well.
Over the years, and I've been part of Partnership for Safety and Justice work, attending their advocacy days, and you have very innovative solutions. And I feel that you have truly changed the narrative of how we do policing, how we do public safety, our criminal legal system here in Oregon. Can you talk about some of the ways you have changed the narrative?
I think part of that, Karen, to your point, is by coming with solutions. Most people, many people anyway, that experience the justice system, whether as someone who's being held accountable by it and punished by it, or as a crime survivor, doesn't leave satisfied with what the system does for them. Many people leave re-traumatized. They don't have the services they need to thrive. They don't get the support they need to be productive in their lives, to get back to work, to get into stable housing. The system doesn't do that for them. So part of what Partnership for Safety and Justice focuses on doing is coming up with solutions that better meet the needs of people impacted by the justice system. And again, that includes survivors and people charged or convicted of crimes. And so I think that's the biggest way we do it, is because when you, like even now, the hot topic issue, right? It's like, what's happening on the streets of Portland, right? There are people out there, they're using drugs, what's happening? And in the end, when even though people are very frustrated, understandably frustrated, when you say, do you want people to go to jail or do you want them to get the treatment they need? People want them to get the treatment they need to help. So that's why we got to invest in those kinds of solutions. And that's how we change the narrative, is not by trying to sell something that people don't want, but actually by giving people what they really need and not the false lack of choice of just a one solution, right? One solution, we're going to lock them up. People get that crime is more complicated than that. People get that when people are harmed, they need more than that, than the person to get locked up. There's a lot more people need. The public understands that. So I think what we do is create and advance those solutions with people impacted by the justice system. So they're real solutions. And I think that helps change the narrative.
In terms of changing the narrative, and this kind of goes back to the coalition work. When you involve the people who are closest to the problem, who have the most experience with what we're talking about, you get to more effective, better solutions. I think that's been a really powerful direction that we've been going, not only like with our coalition having so many folks who've experienced arrest, who've experienced courts, who've experienced supervision, who've been incarcerated, right? Sort of who've come back to the community and had reentry, that process, right? Having folks come up with solutions to the problems that they're seeing at all these different checkpoints is incredibly empowering, healing, and impactful. But then it goes even further. There's like, okay, we come together, we form ideas about legislation and policy change, but then we've actually embraced the opportunity to focus on the implementation, or like, how do you carry out the process of rolling this out in practice or in reality, instead of letting kind of the traditional stakeholders who sort of take it after the legislation passes and do their thing with it, right? We're actually involved in the implementation process more and more now as folks who are justice involved and who are doing the work. So I think that's actually really helping reshape outcomes for our communities.
And that's so important, Vivek, that you are, as you said, passing legislation and policies, and you are out in the community and making sure those laws and those policies are being implemented.
One example of this, Senate Bill 581, which was passed during the last legislative session, specific to the earned discharge program. So folks who are on community supervision actually can complete their supervision at the halfway point. If they qualify and they complete the checklist of requirements for that. And so, you know, you can imagine like there's these arbitrary numbers for how long people are in supervision with a parole probation officer, say, let's say 3 years. And so, you know, really focusing on how well someone is doing, seeing the growth and the positive things that are happening and having that incentive to really be done at a year and a half, right? The halfway point. It's great. This process has actually helped reshape the culture of supervision. That's some of the ongoing kind of larger work that we're doing of reshaping the adult supervision experience to where, you know, POs aren't, parole and probation officers aren't just trying to catch people doing wrong. They're not setting up like these trip wires, only focusing on like the mistakes, but it's actually let's work together to help you thrive and to do well. And so that I, as your probation officer, can advocate for you to complete your supervision early, right? It's very much like the juvenile justice system or the youth system where there's this sort of working with all the stakeholders, all the folks who are connected with the family or youth to help them, you know, accomplish their goals, to thrive and to move forward without supervision and to reinforce the growth. And so we're trying to do that with the adult system, and this earned discharge program has been a tool for that, one avenue. And so what we've actually done more specifically, Karen, is we've created workshops where the folks from our Transform Injustice Coalition have worked in collaboration with Department of Corrections and Community Corrections to create a brochure and a pamphlet, a survey about folks' experience. And we're actually going into community-based organizations who directly serve folks who are impacted. And we're connecting with staff, we're connecting with mentors, case managers, we're connecting with the folks who are on supervision and not only informing them about the earned discharge program and, hey, did you know, right? Like Senate Bill 581, here's all the things, right? But actually talking about how folks can have the tools for their own success, because traditionally in the adult system, there's not a lot of like, I stand up for myself, I speak out or like talk directly to my PO about things that I'm experiencing. It's a very like, it's a compliance model. It's adversarial, right? Like that's sort of the culture. And we're trying to reshape that by giving folks the tools to advocate for their own success, to empower themselves. So it's both, did you know about the earned discharge program and whether you qualify or not? But also let's talk a little bit bigger here because you advocating for yourself isn't a skill for supervision. It's actually a life skill. And so that's sort of like the big piece in terms of implementation and empowering folks.
And as you said, Vivek, that is just one piece of legislation, Senate Bill 581, where your organization was successful in the Oregon legislature. And as I said, you are celebrating your 25th anniversary in December. Talk about some of the accomplishments that you have had. I remember 2013, the major piece of legislation with justice reinvestment. So talk about some of those accomplishments and successes of the organization throughout the years.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk about that, Karen. Yeah, I think the Justice Reinvestment Act passed in 2013, and one of its primary goals was to prevent the need to build a new prison to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in Junction City, Oregon. That felt like the really wrong trajectory for Oregon and our spending priorities. And, you know, we rank 26th about in the country for our incarceration rate, which seems very high compared to, I don't know, Massachusetts, that's number one, has the lowest incarceration rate. Like, how are we so far down the line? So that passed and prevented the need to open that prison and invested now hundreds of millions of dollars instead into counties and local communities to keep people out of prison system, get them treatment, supports they need to be successful. That will help us talk about some legislation we're bringing this session. But one thing we realized over time is that while it helped prevent the need for a new men's prison, we hadn't changed sentences for the crimes that impact women. So several years later, we brought another bill to help prevent the need for a second prison for women. So those kinds of changes have been really foundational to Partnership for Safety and Justice's work, where we're saying we can capture savings or save money that we'd spend on prisons and jails and pull them back into the community. Also, and Bob Eck will probably want to talk about this, as I think many of your listeners would know, Metro 11, which was passed 30 years ago now, Kevin Mannix is actually the author of Measure 11. He has also brought several other ballot measures to increase the prison population in Oregon without really meeting the needs of either survivors of crime or people who've committed crime. So it is not a real solution. It is most expensive and least effective way to do public safety. And it is the biggest driver of mass incarceration and racial disparities in our state. And it has been very hard to change, but we did have a really significant victory around youth in Measure 11. The PSJ and Bob Eck, before he was with PSJ, was really involved in. So maybe, Bob Eck, do you want to talk about the Measure 11 reforms that have happened?
So Measure 11 was passed by Oregon voters in 1994. It's a mandatory minimum bill that was passed that, well, it starts with 15-year-olds. Let's start there, right? So mandatory minimum sentencing for 15-year-olds, right, starting at the age of 15, with the least amount of time being served being 5 years, 10 months, right? So 70 months is the lowest amount of time, day for day. There's no good time, you're doing well, advocacy, let's get this person back home. No, it's 70 months hard time that someone's doing. And you're actually, when it was passed before this reform that we had, you were in the adult system, right? You had adult attorney, you had adult judge. You're going to be likely going to adult prison after some time in the youth correctional system. And so this existed with very minimal change, if anything, no change on a state level for over 20 years, right? And so I think it's about 5 or 6 years ago at this point, which is wild to think, Senate Bill 1008 or 1008 came in front of the legislature. This is right before 2020. And Senate Bill 1008 actually presented a lot of changes for youth. It was a youth justice reform bill. This did not impact adults necessarily, but it was youth in the youth system who faced Measure 11 charges. And there were really significant changes as a result of this historic bill that was passed. It was actually, for me personally, an opportunity to see the power of coalition. There was the Youth Justice Alliance then that I worked with that brought a lot of stakeholders across the state together and organized around this youth justice reform bill. Really powerful to see so many organizations aligning and working together, because this had to happen. It was just so wrong that we were doing this for decades in Oregon, especially treating humans in general, but specifically kids and youth in this sort of manner. And I work with a lot of the kiddos as a family care manager with the Community Healing Initiative, who faced Measure 11 charges and whose lives were devastated, whose families were broken apart. There's a lot of detail I could get into there, but for the sake of our conversation, you know, focusing on Senate Bill 1008 and the changes and that came about and the hope that it gave to communities, especially communities of color, who are disproportionately impacted by Measure 11. So specifically, like, now youth are not automatically charged as adults if they're charged with a Measure 11 crime. There actually has to be a court process where a judge hears the argument by a prosecutor or a district attorney to even have this young individual waived into adult court, which rarely happens now. And it's in the most like serious violent crimes, which is not, you know, 95% or more of this Measure 11 crimes. And so youth typically are now maintained in the youth system, right? And then the second big piece with this is that youth get a second look or a second chance. And so you imagine you have this 70-month sentence and there's no opportunity, no matter what your circumstances, no matter the circumstances of the case, your life, your support, how well you're doing while you're incarcerated. That's different now. With a second look at the halfway point in your time, you can actually have the opportunity to return to the community to finish the second half of your time on supervision in your natural environment, back home with your family, right? And so not being waived automatically into adult court, having the opportunity for a second look are two big pieces. There's more layers to it, like You know, I don't know if folks know, but at the age of 25, if you've been in the youth correctional system, so like Oregon Youth Authority, say you're at the McLaren Youth Correctional Facility, in the past, even if you had like a few months left on your time that you were serving, you'd still go to the adult prison to finish your time, even though you've been like at McLaren, let's say, for like 6, 7, 8 years. Now you end up going into the adult system, into prison with adults. And you can just imagine the like collateral consequences of that and how that affects like your safety, your ability to thrive when you come back home. And so it's been a few years, right? But like, I think it's if you have 1 or 2 years left on your sentence, that actually gets reviewed by a judge and you can actually return to the community instead of going to the adult system. There's a fourth piece related to like sort of juvenile life without parole, essentially getting rid of that with this legislation. But I mean, you can see, you know, for decades, there was no changes to this. And we finally did something for probably the biggest population of people who are affected, which is like youth and young adults. And so Senate Bill 1008 was the big piece with Measure 11 reform. But like I said, it's youth who are involved and we shouldn't have Measure 11, right? And we do. And we did some things to fix and change it, but there's still work to be done.
And I'll just say, in addition to what I said earlier about some of our past reforms, one thing I forgot to note is that with those big reforms where we prevented the need to build the prison in Junction City, we offset the need to have a second prison for women. Both of those savings got reinvested, not just into services for people convicted of crime, but also for crime survivors. So we make sure as part of our holistic approach to justice reform that we're getting victims additional support because victim services are woefully underfunded. And so we've advocated for many years to increase the funding in the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. And again, when we do these sentencing reforms, make sure a portion of that money also gets to crime survivors.
So you're going to have a 25th anniversary celebration. Talk about that.
Yeah, so we have a 25th anniversary celebration on December 4th at Holocene. You can get tickets at safetyandjustice.org/25 years. Like Babak was saying, I think all of us at PSJ feel really privileged to get to do the work we do. It's truly an honor to get to work with both our staff team and all the folks who we engage with. And, you know, there are defeats and there are wins. And this is a real opportunity to celebrate the wins, the hard work, the time that so many people have put into creating this organization, to keeping it going, to being a part of our advocacy work, of our social media work. It's just, I think, as you alluded to, Karen, we've Transforming Justice Coalition is the coalition we put the most energy into. But certainly in my 16 years at Partnership for Safety and Justice, we have convened many coalitions and really hope that everyone who's been a part of our work in the past or wants to be a part of it in the future, is currently a part of it, will join us again on Wednesday, December 4th at Holocene. Tickets at safetyandjustice.org/25 years.
It sounds like a wonderful opportunity to get together before the 2025 legislative session starts on January 21st. So what is your legislative agenda for 2025?
The three priorities for the upcoming session are the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, also known as FSAP, and then preserving Measure 110 Addiction and Harm Reduction Services, and finally the Justice Reinvestment Equity Program, or JREP. The Family Sentencing Alternative Program, FSAP, it's a program that Partnership for Safety and Justice initially passed in 2015, so almost a decade ago. And it prioritizes parents for intensive supervision in the community and for services instead of incarceration or prison, so that they can be accountable for the harm while strengthening bonds with their children and increasing family stability. It's important for a few reasons, right? It keeps families together. This program helps people be accountable for harm without being taken away from their kids who need them. Two, it's fewer kids in foster care. You're keeping a family together in a community as opposed to incarcerating the parent. That keeps families together and kiddos from going into foster care. And we've actually seen that it's pretty common that it actually reunites kiddos with their caretakers, so they spend less time in the foster care system and more time with people they know, need, and love, right? Their family. The other piece with FSAP is that it helps children and families thrive. We know that when more caretakers have the services they need, Oregon kids are more stable, healthy, and secure. And so the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, it's had a lot of potential, but it's also fallen short in a few ways. So we know that not enough people have been served. Very few people of color are being served, and that the narrow qualifications has meant that a lot of kiddos were still losing caretakers to the system, right, to incarceration. And so now, 10 years later, the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, it's getting ready to sunset. It's going to come in front of the legislature to see if we want to continue supporting it and funding it, right, at a 10-year sunset. So this is an opportunity to fix and preserve the program so that more children can be raised by their parents at home. So what we're doing with the new legislation coming up here in the new session, there's three specific updates that we want to do to make this even more impactful. One is for caretakers who are eligible for a downward departure, which is essentially a diversion to probation in the court process. We want to make sure that the folks who are eligible for downward departure can access services that help children and families thrive, right? Anyone who's eligible for a downward departure. So that would really make more folks able to access the program. The second thing is to expand the definition of caretaker to more accurately reflect how kids are raised in Oregon's diverse racial and cultural communities, right? We've had like a very narrow definition of what a parent is, and that's not culturally responsive. And it also limits sort of the connection between kids and caretakers, right? Because that's not always like your biological parent. And then the third piece is connecting people enrolled in the program with culturally specific services. This has been something in our time, Shannon and I having done site visits with the five counties who have this program, because it is an opt-in program. It's not mandatory in every county. Jackson County, Marion County, Washington County, just as like some examples, they've had this program. But then, you know, you think about like culturally specific services and access. We really want to make sure that there's more opportunities for folks to connect to those services. And so the legislation we're proposing will address the gaps that we've seen, and it will definitely improve outcomes so that more kids are raised by their caretakers. But we're really excited about this bill and to make sure that these fixes will have an even greater impact on our community.
So another key part of our advocacy this session is going to be preserving funding under Measure 110. I think a lot of folks have heard in the news that Measure 110 was, overturned, but that's not entirely true. We recriminalized addiction, or we recriminalized drug possession, but those people still need the funding that Measure 110 provided. Prior to Oregon passing Measure 110, we ranked 50th, lowest in the country for our access to treatment services. And the Measure 110 brought in the funding to actually start building up those services. And those services are being built up and providing critical resources that people need to survive, to ultimately recover, to thrive. And so one of the things we will be doing this session is making sure no one comes after that funding. No one's threatening to come after it yet, but we know anytime there's money to be had, people will try and have it. And we want to make sure it's clear that that part of Measure 110 was not changed. We still need those services in our communities, as everyone's seen. They include, addiction treatment, housing, peer services, street outreach, programs for people coming out of prisons, culturally specific programs in all 36 counties and the 9 tribes. Like, this is vital money for Oregon to thrive in the way that we all want to see. And so we will be working with partners to make sure that that funding stays in place and continues, because cutting it off now would really be a disservice, especially at the moment that now that we are recriminalizing addiction, which I misspoke earlier, but it is actually true. People get traumatized when they get incarcerated. That makes those services even more essential. If we truly want to get to the root causes of these problems, we've got to support people. And so that funding is going to remain critical funding stream to support us.
Side of the Family Sentencing Alternative Program and the Measure 110 funding, preserving it, there's also the Justice Reinvestment Equity Program. And so, we talked earlier about our focus on reducing prison use, advancing community safety, and promoting healing, which are all key values in the criminal justice reform movement. And then the Justice Reinvestment Equity Program is an exciting new approach that accomplishes all three of these things. The way this happens is by elevating organizations that have been overlooked by traditional funding streams with the goals of reducing incarceration and racial disparities in the criminal justice system. The focus here is to specifically support the people and communities that are most harmed and least helped by the criminal justice system. And here's why. If we want to seriously reduce mass incarceration in Oregon, we need to improve program outcomes for all communities. And a key component is to address racial disparities. When people of color access services designed by white organizations or white-run agencies, they are statistically less likely to successfully complete the program as intended. It's for a variety of reasons, right? Including language barriers, geographic proximity, organizations that are already delivering other services to the community, having program leads that are far from your own community and that you may know. So to address these disparities, the 2022 Oregon legislature passed a grant program that funds projects that are more qualified to serve people of color. It's amazing to see that 18 organizations across Oregon have received funding. The programs include victim and survivor services, violence reduction, and services that prevent involvement in the criminal legal system, and then reentry, diversion, and services that reduce involvement in the legal system. In 2022, the program funded at about $325,000. Huge impact in the community. They're running across Oregon. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. We want to make sure that these critical services continue to be funded.
Let's talk about how people can get involved in the 2025 legislative session.
Yeah, so, you know, laws don't pass without support. We need people, we need community coming together and supporting us to support this work. So there'll be lots of opportunities for engagement. I think, as Karen, you mentioned, the legislative session doesn't start till January 21st. But even before that, we will likely have opportunities where you can email your legislator, you can share about these pieces of legislation on social media. And then as you can come to Salem with us and advocate, meet your legislators and talk about these policies in person. Those are just a few ways. There are other opportunities. We'd love for you to go to our website at safetyandjustice.org and click on the Get Involved button to join us for these. And also, of course, follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Shannon White and Bebek Zolbagari-Azar, thank you so much and all the best in this upcoming 2025 legislative session. And congratulations on 25 years.
Thank you, Karen. We look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, thank you, Karen. Blessings, everyone.
This is Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Thank you to our engineer.
And thank you for listening. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.